Okay, I guess we're going to get going if everyone wants to settle down. I don't know if the AV guy can put up my slides. I'm Dave Solid. So unfortunately, Rob Glassman was unable to attend last minute, so I'm going to try to moderate this session, and given the fact that Neil's in the panel, that's always, you know, a little bit of a challenge. So I don't know if you can bring up the initial slides. I'm just going to give an intro. I'll just wait for that. Okay, so I guess this is the panel, and I'm just going to have everyone introduce themselves maybe real quickly. Barbara, you want to just start and introduce yourself? And
sure. I'm Barb Conley. I'm the head of the Cancer Diagnosis Program in the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis at NCI.
Sean?
I'm Sean Faree. I'm the Vice President of Diagnostic Development at NanoString Technologies.
I'm Neil Rosen. I study signaling at Memorial Sloan Kettering, where I trained David Solid, and now I carry David Solid's bags to the airport.
Not really good at it.
There's some feedback there. Hi, I'm Cecilia Schott, and I head the business development group responsible for personalized health care within AstraZeneca.
Okay, so I guess the purpose of this session is to use the extraordinary responder paradigm and initiative to really address two issues. One is an issue around patient selection and development of molecular diagnostics, and we're going to hear a little bit of a intro on that from Sean a little bit later, and then hopefully Cecilia will give us her input in terms of the industry perspective for the development of diagnostic studies in the era when we can do multiplex testing, and how that hopefully will change. And then Barbara and I will talk about the extraordinary responders. But just, again, using this as a paradigm for why drugs sometimes fail, why they succeed, and how we can try to do that a little bit more efficiently. So really I wanted to open really with the concept of why do drugs fail in the clinic. And I think that was my impetus of getting involved in the study of these extraordinary responders. And I really think that there's two reasons that drugs fail in the clinic. And the first of those, it's a bad target. So we develop a drug, and it's not a good target for that particular patient, so the drug fails. And there's three reasons that it can be a bad target. I'm going to go through them quickly in a few slides. But one is just the simple, that target is not a driver in that particular tumor. And I think that's not appreciated enough, and is why we initially are interested in doing patient selection. But there's two other reasons that drugs can fail because it's a bad target, even when that target is a driver of the cancer phenotype or transformation. One of those is that there may be co-mutations that make a single-agent approach ineffective, and in that case, we simply need to use combinations, and we need diagnostics to be able to determine who are those patients in whom we need to do a combination. And then I want to introduce this concept that not everyone in the audience may be familiar with, but is something that is becoming a big deal now that we have next-gen sequencing of tumors, which is this concept of clonality, which is there may be evidence of the mutation in the tumor, but if that mutation's not in every cell in the tumor, the likelihood that a targeted agent is going to work is minimal because the cells that don't have the mutation may simply grow out very quickly and cause resistance. So I think one reason drugs fail in the clinic is that it's a bad target. The second is that it's a bad drug. And this is the case where you've got the right target, you got the right patient, you give the compound, but maybe you don't inhibit the target hard enough or long enough to see a good anti-tumor response. And so coming from this viewpoint, which at least the second half really came out of my work working in Neil's lab, you know, I was really intrigued by the extraordinary responders. And the reason for that is, at least for the extraordinary responders, you know, at least in that one patient, it's not a bad drug. You know the drug was able to get to the target. You knew it was able to inhibit some target. The issue is, what was that target, and why did that patient respond uniquely so well? So the inspiration for this entire initiative at our institution was this case. And if you haven't heard this case, I'll go through it really quickly. This was a 73-year-old with metastatic bladder cancer. This is a cancer where we've made really no progress over the past three decades, and this is the Cancer Progress Conference. So unfortunately, bladder cancer hasn't been discussed much because there hasn't been any progress. And we did a trial like many of the trials we've done in bladder cancer, in that we enrolled 45 patients onto a study of single-agent everolimus and it was a negative study statistically. So in if you look at the entire population, we didn't reach the statistical endpoint, which was a certain progression-free survival compared to historical controls. We didn't get that. There were only two patients who had RECIST responses. And so based upon that result, the conclusion was everolimus doesn't work in patients with bladder cancer. But this patient really intrigued us. I want to go forward. I thought that was a pointer, but it's not. This patient really intrigued us, and I'm showing their CAT scans here. This is a patient who presented in the summer of 2009 with metastatic disease, had neoadjuvant chemo, underwent surgical resection, quickly developed a recurrence, and then for no particular reason other than it was an open trial at our institution at the time, was enrolled on the everolimus study. By April 2010, had a near complete response. July 2010, a complete response, and that complete response has now been ongoing. She celebrated her fifth-year anniversary, still on everolimus, is in fact the only patient from the trial who's still alive. So this is a case where she had an extraordinary response to everolimus. The rest of the patients really did relatively poorly, and the question is, why did she do uniquely so well? So luckily, whole genome sequencing was becoming feasible at the time that we were getting this result. We did actually the first whole genome sequence of a patient with bladder cancer, and in retrospect, when you look at that patient's genome, it becomes kind of obvious why she did uniquely well. She actually had two mutations, one a inactivating mutation in TSC1, the second an inactivating mutation in NF2, both of which activate TORC1, which is the direct target of everolimus. So if you look in retrospect, it's kind of obvious that she was a great candidate for everolimus. What this patient tells us is that everolimus can get into the tumor, can inhibit mTOR at least sufficiently in this patient to induce an anti-tumor response, but why doesn't it work well in other patients? And so I'm just going to show this other slide we had in the paper, and this is where we took another 14 patients with bladder cancer from that study. It was the only patients we could get tissue from. We sequenced those tumors, and we found that there were several other patients with TSC1 mutations. We actually found no other patients with NF2 mutations. And what was notable is that all the patients who had even a minimal response to the drug had TSC1 mutations, but not everyone with a TSC1 mutation had an extraordinary response. And if you look at that data, I don't know if you can see it well because I can't really see it from here. Some of those patients had co-mutations in FGFR3, and one could sort of hypothesize that if we gave an FGFR3 inhibitor to those patients who also had a TSC1 mutation, that FGFR3 inhibitor could turn a double FGFR3 TSC1 mutant into an extraordinary responder. So again, I don't think we think every patient with one single mutation is going to have an extraordinary response if we've seen it in one patient. What we want to do is have subsequent clinical trials where we sort of work out these details as to what's the co-mutation pattern and what's maybe the best combination for most patients. We've done the same paradigm for other patients. Just going to mention one other quick case, and Barbara might mention one when she presents the initiative. This is a patient with low-grade serous ovarian cancer, was on a GOG study, GOG 239. On this trial, there were 60-something patients, only 7 of whom responded. A couple of them had KRAS mutations, so that made sense. But there was really no correlation between genetic results and response, and that's in part because they only sequenced for KRAS G12 mutations and V600E BRAF mutations and didn't look broader. This was, in fact, the only patient on the trial who had a complete response, which is now 5.5 years and ongoing. She, again, remains the only patient still on the MEK inhibitor from this study. So what's going on in her tumor? It doesn't always have to be rocket science, and it's always seemingly obvious in retrospect. Turns out that she has a mutation in a gene called MAP2K1, which is interesting because MAP2K1 encodes for MEK. And so this is a patient with a 5.5-year complete response to a MEK inhibitor who has a MEK1 mutation. And the question is this a real MEK1 mutation? She, in fact, has a difficult-to-detect deletion. She's got a 15-base pair deletion, which causes an in-frame deletion of 5 amino acids, which is in the negative regulatory sequence of the kinase. And if you go ahead and you make that MEK1 mutant, you can find that it's incredibly hyperactivating and transforming. So again, in retrospect, she's the first patient. She's the optimal patient for this approach. But can we actually now maybe do clinical trials more rationally going forward by identifying patients with MEK1 mutations and asking how many of them respond to the MEK inhibitor? And those patients exist. So this is a patient now in our prospective sequencing efforts. We're using an assay with 410 cancer-associated genes in it. And this is a patient with melanoma who has a different MEK1 mutation. In this case, this is a 2-amino acid deletion in 102, 103, a little bit further down the protein. And if you go ahead and you make this MEK1 mutation, you can see this is a hyperactivating MEK1 mutation. So, again, is this patient going to respond? I don't know. But I want to test that prospectively. And that, to me, is the real paradigm for the Extraordinary Responder Initiative. We take some of these extraordinary responders. We do genetics to try to figure out what makes them unique. We always go back to the lab to sort of try to support that hypothesis with laboratory studies. What we then need is a test. We need assays, and then you'll hear that from other people in the panel, is how do we develop those assays? We need tests that can look for these patients prospectively in all patients so that we can do another clinical trial. I'm not arguing that the MEK inhibitor should be available to everyone with a MEK1 mutation as a standard of care, not arguing that we should be giving everolimus to every patient with a TSC1 mutation, but what I'm arguing for is clinical trials where we could really ask that question. And so how do you do those clinical trials? Just a couple more slides for me. One way is to do them through master protocols and things like that. And, you know, I'm hoping that we can have a little bit of a debate among a panel as to the pros and cons of that approach. But the approach that I've been pushing, and we've been pushing a bit at Sloan Kettering, is this idea of a basket study. And I think what I like about this approach is it allows us to sort of ask this defined biologic hypothesis in the most efficient way, meaning we can open up one study at the institution and cover every single cancer. So this is a study of patients with HER2 mutations that we've opened up at Sloan Kettering and now at about 20 other institutions with Puma, I guess biotechnology or I don't know what the rest of the Puma name is, but with Puma. Again, if you have a HER2 mutation, you're eligible for the study. You go onto the study. We have different arms for breast cancer and bladder cancer and colon cancer. We always have an other arm because we never quite know who's going to show up. And we've seen some extraordinary responses now prospectively with this approach. So this is a patient with breast cancer with quote-unquote HER2 normal disease because it's not FISH amplified. But the patient has a V77L mutation in HER2. This is a mutation in the kinase domain analogous to an L858R EGFR mutation. And you can see this patient, there's the scans in July 2014. She had been on multiple systemic agents and was refractory to all those. You can see by September 2014, she's had a complete response. And really the take-home point that I would want to make is not that the HER2 biology is that novel, but the fact that almost all patients in this country who have this mutation don't know they have this mutation, even when they have metastatic disease, because we don't routinely test for this mutation. So I think the extraordinary responders bring up hypotheses like this, and then the question is, how do we efficiently do these clinical trials? How do we find the patients? How do we organize the clinical trials to actually ask the question? Do we do it as master protocols in just melanoma, for example, or breast cancer, where we have different drugs in the same trial, or do we do these basket designs? I think that's a major question that the community is kind of fighting with. I just would mention a few advantages of the basket study. We've done a calculation that to actually enroll that basket study for neratinib, we'd have to screen between 30 and 40,000 patients to find enough patients with HER2 mutations because it's rare in all the cancers where it's found. And who's going to pay for all that screening? So in the basket study, we don't pay for any of the screening. Screening is completely independent of the study. It doesn't matter how the HER2 mutation was found, either using our internal assay or one at MD Anderson or Foundation One testing or some other, you know, commercial enterprise. As long as they have the mutation, they're eligible for the study. And that allows us to leverage essentially the entire population in the U.S. as well as in Europe to find enough patients with the mutation to ask this question. Does lineage matter? I think we clearly have seen that lineage does matter. So we find that with BRAF inhibitors, there's a 60% response rate to vemurafenib in lung cancer, vemurafenib in melanoma. In lung cancer, it's about 40%. In colon, it's about 0%. In histiocytosis, it's about 100%. So we don't, again, claim that we're going to see the same level of response and that all that matters is the mutation and that tumor type is not important. What we want to do is be able to study that, and by enrolling these different arms, we can actually answer that question. So, again, I just want to summarize and say, why do drugs fail? One is bad target. The other is bad drug. When you've seen an extraordinary response, it's not necessarily an issue of bad drug. It's maybe giving it to the wrong patient. And, you know, is that because you're giving it to patients who don't even have the mutations that are relevant? Is it because you need to use combination because they're co-mutations? Or this issue of clonality? And I just want to quickly introduce that in three slides. This is a Foundation Medicine a report that was sent to me regarding a patient as to whether they would be a good candidate for the basket study. And you can see this patient had a HER2 mutation. It was an S310F mutation. That's actually the most common mutation in HER2 that we see in cancer. And next to the S310F, Foundation said subclonal. And so we got this report back, and we didn't really know what that meant. I called up Foundation, asked them, what's your definition of subclonal? And they wouldn't really tell me what their exact definition is, but I'll just show you some highlighted data from our series so you can understand this concept a little bit. So this is a patient with a breast cancer, and I just made this bigger so you could see, and you can see they've got a kinase domain mutation in HER2. It's an L755S, and you can see the allele frequency of that mutation is 58%. And what that means is that this is a digital technology with next-gen sequencing. If we sequence, you know, 1,000 reads at that spot, 58% of them have the HER2 mutation. And you never get 100%, even if it's a homozygous mutation, because you have some degree of stromal normal cell intermixture. And so this is one where you can see it's a high allele frequency, and it's high even in comparison to other mutations within that same tumor. And maybe this is one where you've lost the wild copy of allele, the wild type copy of allele, or maybe you've got conversion to homozygosity or a little bit of amplification. Whereas here's another case. This is a bladder cancer case where you can see the P53 has a 57% allele frequency, TSC1 has a 62% allele frequency, but HER2 has a 3% allele frequency. And so what this is sort of inferring, and we can't do good copy number or clonality analysis with this type of data. We really need whole exome, whole genome. But this data really suggests that this tumor has a situation where not every cell in the tumor has a HER2 mutation, and what's the likelihood that this patient's really going to respond to a HER2 inhibitor. So if you've got a diagnostic assay that's a PCR-based assay that's a sort of plus-minus, you know, outcome, yes, you've got a BRAF mutation or no, got a HER2 mutation or no, you're losing this information that could also be dictating who's going to respond. Just to give you another example, this is another bladder cancer patient where you can see, and we're showing four separate tumors, and the dots are showing which mutations are in which tumors. All the tumors have the TERT mutation. All the tumors have the MLL2 mutation, which is KMT2D. All the tumors have CDKN1A. But just tumor 1 has the HER2 mutation. Tumor 3 has an EGFR mutation. Tumors 2 and 4 have PIK3CA. So you can imagine what's the likelihood of this patient responding to a HER2 inhibitor. Probably low, because the clones that don't have HER2 are going to very quickly grow out. And this may even appear as intrinsic de novo resistant and not even as acquired resistance. So the discussion points I'm hoping to get, you know, throughout this session is a little bit of talk about, does lineage matter? So we see you have this case report of an extraordinary response in one cancer. Should that really be used as justification to use a drug off indication or, you know, in another cancer? Or should we not always be, you know, just suggesting clinical trials with this paradigm? How do we reach the goal of universal screening for druggable mutations? Maybe we'll hear a little bit from NanoString about how we're going to get there. And maybe a little bit of discussion of this umbrella/master protocol concept versus the basket study. I'd also encourage anyone at any point during this to maybe, you know, ask questions to the panel. I don't think we have to have it just at the end for questions. People can ask questions at any time. I'm just going to bring Barbara up, and maybe, or I don't know if Barbara wants to present sitting down, but maybe bring up Barbara's slides, and she can just talk about the initiative that's ongoing.
So this is forward, that's back. There is no point.
Oh, thanks, David. So I just described to you an NCI initiative that in some sense had its springboard from some of the studies David and others have done, but really resonates, I think, with most of the clinicians who have had patients who, for whatever reason, responded and stayed responded, despite the fact that most of the other patients didn't, and they all usually died. So I just have a few slides. And so first thing, when you want to put up an initiative, it's good to define what you mean by exceptional responder, because it can be defined in many different ways. We are confining ourselves in this initiative to systemic treatments, to which patients had a complete response or a partial response lasting at least 6 months in either an investigational drug that did not go on to FDA approval for that indication due to insufficient activity, or else in a standard treatment where you wouldn't expect that in 10% or more of patients. Now, we also took into account the idea that there are exceptional responders that respond for a very long time, even though, you know, you may get a substantial number of people responding to that treatment. They don't respond for 3-4 years. So those patients also are included as exceptional responders in that. And then, so we wanted to get this out of the community. In preparation for all of these things, we actually looked at the NCI's catalog of clinical trials for the 10 years or so, and found that basically roughly 10% of those patients were exceptional responders in drugs that didn't go on for that indication. So we proposed that if patients who are exceptional responders, their clinicians can send us by email de-identified information, and we would kind of look it over and see, okay, was this an exceptional response or not? We opened it up to the entire community. Protocol is on the clinical trials support unit website, and it's going in through our uniform database, Open and Rave. And we've just added now our imaging colleagues, because while we kind of look back at clinical trials, the exceptional responders that are getting proposed are usually not on clinical trials. Therefore, none of their tumors are measured by RECIST. So once the case is deemed exceptional, then we request the tissue. The patient has to have tissue from before the exceptional response, and the tissue is brought in to the system. We have a central repository that accepts and prepares the DNA and RNA at Nationwide Children's Hospital, riffing off the TCGA infrastructure for the Center for Cancer Genomics. And the DNA is going to Baylor for whole exome sequencing and any other and mRNA sequencing. And if there's enough tissue, enough analyte, that will go on for whole genome. Foundation Medicine has joined us as a scientific partner, and they will be doing their Foundation One panel on these as well as potentially referring patients. So the other interesting thing about this is that whoever submits the case will be part of the team that analyzes it. So you could read this as we need all the help we can get. So here's where we are almost to date, not as of last week, but almost to date, 138 cases proposed by the email, conditionally accepted 72. 29 of these were on a clinical trial, and only a few of those were on one single targeted agent kind of trial, which is kind of interesting to us. We've gotten 6 tumors in, because remember we started this in September, and so before you can send tumor, you have to get an MTA, you have to get the IRB to approve the tumor, yada, yada. So we're just getting the tumors in now. But there are some surprises. First is, we did not think that most patients would still be living, and they are. And they're exceptional responders to everything. And so they're signing the consent themselves. And most cases are also not from clinical trials, but from standard treatment. And they come from everywhere, so as you could expect. So it's very exciting. We're just starting out, and what do we hope to learn? We hope to learn, you know, obviously, if from the targeted agents, the single targeted agents, some of the factors that might influence response, but also on standard agents, begin to get at why those patients would be exceptional responders. Thanks.
Okay, so thanks, Barbara. So I don't know if you just want to have a little discussion now. I can sort of prompt people. I don't know if anyone has something they're dying to say. But really the case that was the inspiration for me that got me interested in studying that everolimus case was the case of Avastin in patients with breast cancer. So this was in the news a lot, in that the drug was FDA approved. It seemed like a perfect drug for a drug company, in that there was a small benefit in everyone, maybe, and across the board, so you could sell a lot of it, and it was making billions of dollars in breast cancer. But the benefit was incredibly small. There were some patients who had this great response, but most maybe were not benefiting at all, and ultimately that drug was withdrawn. And just reading the blog comments on the New York Times. So you go to the New York Times and there's the comments, you know, that you can sit hours reading those comments about any particular news story. But there would be patients in those comments that were saying, you know, I've been on Avastin for 8 years. You know, I had stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. My doctor said I had 6 months to live. I went on Avastin, and now 8 years later, all my cancers have gone away, and my kids have graduated from college, and one's getting married, and this is a huge deal for me. And how can they possibly think about pulling this from the market? So, you know, for me, that was, you know, something where it was clear that if we could figure out what made those patients unique, we could save that drug in breast cancer, because there were clearly some patients who were responding. I'm not sure that's a view that the drug company loves, because if you're saving it in breast cancer, but it's only going to be applicable in 1% of patients with breast cancer, then the market potential of the drug becomes very small. And that seems to be why I think some people are not that enthusiastic about the extraordinary response responder approach, because it's really narrowing down your population potentially dramatically. So I'm not sure if Neil has any comments. He always loved that story. Or whether you think at NanoString you can help out with this, you know?
I mean, I think the biomarker research has to be done on exceptional responders, and the work that you've already shown, David, I think is key, and we need to keep on doing those things. I do think that there needs to be collaborations between industry and academia on this, though. In order for this to actually make it out there and to help patients, then we need to have buy-in from pharmaceutical companies, from diagnostic companies, and we need to work together to find the right targets. And I'd be interested, Barbara, in comments from you on the program that you have going on already about industry involvement there from biopharma as well as diagnostics, or the lack thereof.
So our foundation is not a diagnostics company, but close. And so they were very interested in this whole problem, in fact, because, you know, as they told us, you know, they're sending these tests out, and it's like, you know, well, what happened? You know, we told you had these mutations. Did you treat the patient with anything? What happened to that patient? So they want to know, does their test do anything good? Several pharma companies have discussed with us the possibility of how can they put forward their exceptional responders. And some of them are doing their own. But I don't think that, I think that as much of this as we can get done is would be great. The key thing is, once we get this information, that it will be available on a controlled access database for people to use in their future research, which is, I think, key.
Cecile, I don't know if you want to comment. You're the one lone drug company representative on the panel.
I can handle it, I think. see if I survive half an hour. So I think the perspective that, you know, the pharma companies will not be investing into the narrow indications has actually evolved, because the way we're developing drugs today, and primarily in oncology, you know, you don't have an option anymore. It's not an all-comers, and it's not, and we know that just from a better understanding of the pathology and the disease at a molecular level. So one example from an AstraZeneca perspective is the recent launch of olaparib, Lynparza, in ovarian cancer, which is a very narrow indication. So for those of you who have followed it, it was initially being developed in breast and ovarian, and the scientific data really supported the ovarian, which is a much narrower market than the breast. And we just decided that, you know what, that's where we're going to go, because the science is there to support it. So I think there's been a shift and an evolution in the pharma thinking that really drives, at least I don't speak for AstraZeneca, because I can speak for all pharma, go where the science really stands. And that has been the approach that we have taken. So, but said that, there is a limited resources into everything you can go. So I think some of your examples, and I know you're going to ask me about the MAC inhibitor, so I'll talk about it right now, which is selinetinib, which is being developed for lung, and is being prioritized, you know, primarily in lung. There was a study done in melanoma, and I have your ovarian cancer that, but when you have the resources, where do you put it, those? And the internal decision within AstraZeneca has been made, and I can speak to that, based on science and not on market size. And I think that has been a shift where we were some time ago as an industry overall.
I'd like to support that. And then you can hire me, and there can be two people on the panel in the company.
I'm doing well here.
AstraZeneca is using their MEK inhibitor, you didn't mention this, in patients with neurofibromatosis, which is not a big market, and it's also using it in patients, kids, small children, with polycytic astrocytomas, which always have, almost always have RAF mutations, many of which are not sensitive, the type of RAF mutation that's not inhibited by standard RAF inhibitors. And that's from a market point of view. If you're talking about ovarian as small, polycytic astrocytomas is 0.1% of that. So I want to make maybe two points of the fact that success engenders problems because we have new issues. So, and what we can do. And I turn to the NCI because we know that their resources are infinite. One problem that I've had, and I have fights with David about this, and he's, of course, right about this, but it's sort of an emotional fight. What happens when you do your sequencing and you find a HER2 mutation and an FGFR mutation? Or I think I know a lot about RAF, a RAF mutation and an FGFR mutation. I think as contentious as that field is, I think most experts would sit there and say, this patient might benefit from a RAF. The FGFR should make you semi or completely resistant to the RAF inhibitor. The combination makes enormous sense. There's lots of papers on it. You just can't do it. And David keeps reminding me every time he yells at me, you need trials and you have to follow rules. But the fact is we are up against a situation with sequencing where we get genotypes that we at least suggest a strong clinical hypothesis. Those strong clinical hypotheses might be wrong when you test them, but the fact is we think we know what to do for a set of patients. And this happens all the time. We sequence lots of patients, thanks to David and his center. You think you know what to do, but you can't do it. That's point one I want to make for new things. The second is to Barbara, and I have one slight disagreement with the trial entry criteria, but not a real one. I understand that you have to define extraordinary responses, but I just want to give this as an example. And, of course, you make up a straw man. It can sound very strong even though you don't have it. Suppose you had a drug that caused a PRs in 80% of patients with pancreas cancer, and they were really abrupt, disappear, and the tumor came back in 4 months or 3 months. By and large, that's what you saw. Well, you can't define everything, so that's not, I'm not really criticizing that. We think that a patient like that, or I think, one of the big possibilities is its adaptation. It's feedback reactivation. You activate other things. So within these trials, and I'd love to have infinite resources, and I'm turning to you for the infinite resource here, we would like to biopsy those patients periodically. We would like to do nanostring or some sort of RNA sequencing or something to figure out what's going on, because with this set of patients that's molecularly defined, again, a molecularly defined therapy, we can learn an enormous amount. And it's not just did they respond or not. We can do a lot of ancillary things. I'm certain everybody here agrees. The question is, how do you set this up and how do you get the resources to do it? Because periodic biopsies and complete molecular characterization is hard and it's resource intense even for a major company.
So, you know, for me, I think those are all great questions, but, you know, just as drug companies in the NCI have limited resources, so does Memorial Sloan Kettering. You know, it's we don't have enough to sequence everyone multiple times in each patient. And so, you know, I think we're quickly trying to get to the goal where we sequence everyone at least once. But the dilemma from the Extraordinary Responder Initiative is, you know, every time we find a TSC1 mutation or a MEK1 mutation, should we not be trying the MEK or the TSC1 or the everolimus for TSC1? The problem is we don't really have access to the drugs. So, you know, would that, you know, deter me from doing the sequencing? If it was my family, I'd still do the sequencing, and then I try to get them the drug. But the disappointment, and I think why some people are not happy with the current system, is that we've got a fairly large group of patients with potential druggable alterations, but there aren't any clinical trials, and we can't get the drug off indication. Now, does that mean we shouldn't be doing the sequencing? I don't think so, because the sequencing is at least now going to define the populations we want to do clinical trials in the future and where the clinical trials we need to get open later. But right now, those clinical trials don't exist. So I'm actually going to have you, do you want to give your quick presentation about sort of diagnostics a little bit, and then we can talk about maybe how we should do the diagnostics, and then maybe a little bit about the clinical trials. Yeah, that's definitely. Yeah. I don't know if you want to bring up Sean's slides. Yeah.
All right. Well, for those of you who were here yesterday, you heard it said this is the most commonly presented figure ever in oncology, and so I thought we had to have it on both days, and so I put it up today as well. The hallmarks of cancer are widely recognized as an organizing principle for cancer research. And I think the key here is that it distills the complexity of cancer down to the fundamental processes that we can describe with pathway biology. And it simplifies our understanding of cancer biology, but without oversimplifying it. And I think, you know, it's important, something that Neil said here, is that there's a spectrum of responses. And this really shouldn't come as a surprise that there's a spectrum of responses to these therapies, because it really reflects the spectrum of disease that's present in the biology here, the spectrum of biology present in the disease. And it's important for us to understand that entire spectrum. And exceptional responders are very important. They are at one extreme of that spectrum, but really the entire spectrum matters. You know, and we've spent a long time, many years now, looking at single markers. The HER2 was discussed in the last session, as well as ER as markers for drugs and breast cancer. But single markers are challenging. They oftentimes aren't able to sufficiently predict the response to these targeted therapies that we have. On the left here, I'm showing a data from a phase 1 PD-1 study, showing that these are patients who are all PD-L1 negative. And in this case, we still see a substantial population here that have very good response to these PD-1 inhibitors. And yet we aren't able to predict that by measuring a single marker PD-L1. On the right, I'm showing data from a lymphoma study with a targeted therapy for EZH2, the inhibitor of EZH2 here. And in the preclinical models, it was thought that this could be a oncogenic driver mutation that the tumor was addicted to, especially in some subtypes of lymphoma, in particular the GCB subtype of lymphoma. But this is data from a first in human study of the EZH2 inhibitor, and one of the surprising things here was, yes, it was an active drug, it was a safe and an active drug, so there's some excitement there, but none of the patients who responded to this drug actually had mutations in EZH2. And I think that this goes back to some of the discussions we've had over the last couple of days, talking about the biology of the disease. It's not just about the oncogenic drivers. It really is about the pathway biology of the disease. And it's very likely that this EZH2 inhibitor is blocking some of those natural pathways, escape pathways of the disease, and that's what's leading to some response in this case, even though EZH2 is not an oncogenic driver. So what NanoString has developed is a series of applications, a highly multiplexed platform that can give precise measurements of many different analytes in a single experiment. So we no longer have to focus on just single analytes, and with that, better understand tumor biology. So I'm just showing a snapshot here of some of the products that we offer. The NanoString nCounter platform is a genomics research tool. We have a suite of different products here that are used in life science research at many of the institutions that I'm sure that you all are here from. We can measure gene expression from single cells, for example, by amplifying RNA from single cells. We can actually look at that, and that's important for some of the questions around tumor heterogeneity that we've been discussing earlier today. We can actually probe DNA copy number here as well. The technology does not detect single point mutations, but it does detect copy number variations in DNA. It's primarily used for gene expression measurements, up to 800 different targets in a single reaction. And it's important to know that there's no enzymology in this assay. We're actually directly hybridizing to the mRNA from these samples. And so that makes it very compatible with FFPE samples. There's no reverse transcription of the RNA, and so that we can directly measure it and count it digitally. We can also measure microRNAs and gene fusions, which of course are very important in oncology. And then finally, we're developing a protein detection assay here, so we can actually multiplex multiplex multi-omic applications. In addition to measuring DNA and RNA in a single assay, we'll be able to measure proteins. So with just a small amount of tissue, we'll be able to get a lot of information across multiple different types of analytes. And then finally, you know, all of our goals here in biomarker research, it's not about just making a beautiful discovery, though that is very exciting. We really want to translate those discoveries into the clinic. And NanoString is doing that as well. We develop in vitro diagnostics. We take those diagnostics through the FDA with regulatory approval so we can actually impact patients' lives. And we've done that first in breast cancer. And Brad Gray talked yesterday, our CEO, about Prosigna, our first diagnostic that we've taken through the FDA. And we are working on others now. So a little more about multiomics. This is the vision for the future that NanoString has. With just a small amount of tissue, we'll be able to prep that tissue from just a few FFPE slices, isolate DNA, RNA, and protein, and analyze those analytes simultaneously on the same system. We can measure up to 800 different analytes in a single reaction, and so the vision here is that we'll be able to multiplex together copy number variations, gene expression measurements, gene fusions, microRNAs, and protein measurements all in the same assay and all in a single tube. So how are we applying that? There was at the AGBT meeting just a couple weeks ago, Marco Island, it was mentioned, I just want to get the quote right here, it was mentioned by Levi Garraway that immuno-oncology is the mother of all biomarker problems. So this is actually a problem that we're trying to help solve. What I'm showing here on the left are three different panels that we've developed. First of all, what we call our pan-cancer pathways panel. This is a panel of 800 different genes that can characterize the 13 canonical pathways of cancer and provide you information on what the biology that's happening within a tumor. We can couple that then with a second panel, our immune response panel. And this is specifically focused at immuno-oncology applications, combining probes to identify the immune cell types in a sample, as well as the innate immune response and the adaptive immune response. And then finally, a third panel that we're going to be launching shortly, which is a progression panel looking at epithelial to mesenchymal transition, looking at extracellular remodeling, looking at metastasis and other markers. Again, 800 genes there. We can couple those together to fully understand all of the hallmarks of cancer in a tumor. And then the really exciting thing is that we don't have to stop there. We don't have to stop at gene expression. We can add on proteins. And so the idea here is that, of course, proteins is what drives biology. We can add in on top of those 770 different genes, we can add in 30 different proteins and actually monitor what's happening in the cell at the proteomic level as well. And so, as I said, we're translating these tools into the clinic. And just three quick examples here of that translation. First of all, laboratory-developed tests. This was a test that was developed originally in the laboratories at Pfizer for ALK ML4 fusions in lung cancer for crizotinib. And this is to detect rare translocations, like ALK, ROS, and RET translocations, which really you can't do feasibly using FISH. But instead, we can multiplex many different fusion partners together into a single assay and identify these patients who would be good candidates for this drug, even though you normally would not feasibly be able to do that in the laboratory using traditional techniques. We're also developing in vitro diagnostic kits, such as Prosigna, our breast cancer assay. And then finally, we are developing companion diagnostics, and that's a bit of a firebrand in this audience right now. I know we don't want companion diagnostics, but we have a similar vision to the vision that's been put out there by panelists earlier today. We're developing a companion diagnostic for DLBCL. This is to subtype DLBCL into two subtypes, the activated B-cell and the germinal center B-cell subtypes of DLBCL. And really, this isn't meant to be a one-test, one-drug. There are many different therapeutics that target these different subtypes of DLBCL. And we envision a future where this is one test, many drugs, which I think goes very well with the vision that's been discussed earlier today. And I just wanted to finish, this is my last slide, but I wanted to finish with a personal story. In 1997, my father was diagnosed with stage 4 DLBCL. And 1997 was a good year to be diagnosed with DLBCL. For those of you who know, that's the year that rituximab was approved. And he was an exceptional responder, and he's still alive today. So thank you very much.
So I just want to have a little bit of discussion about this concept of again, how do we follow up these exceptional responders, and how do we, I guess you there's already been a bunch of discussion about companion diagnostics, but I think it fits in well with this discussion here, which is how do we pay for this and how do we do this in the clinic? You know, right now the test that we run at Sloan Kettering, the bill for the test is $3,200. So we bill $3,200 to do 410 genes. All exons of those genes, certain intronic regions, which will capture certain fusions. But we can only bill for about 30% of the solid tumor cases that we see at all. We can bill for patients with melanoma. We can bill for patients with lung cancer, thyroid cancer, colon cancer, diffuse gliomas, and GIST tumors. And that's because, at least in those cancers, there's at least one mutation which guides patient care for a standard of care therapy. For patients with GIST tumors, a KIT mutation, for melanoma, BRAF mutation, for lung, EGFR, and others. And so we can bill for it. So my question to you, Sean, is, you know, the science sounds great. You know, I'd love to be able to get DNA, RNA, proteomics, you know, on every patient. But how does the company, you know, see the development of this and actually, you know, deployment into the clinic? Or, you know, so are you either going to try to piggyback on something that's already known and then have other things multiplexed in the assay that you get for free initially, but you're hoping that eventually that's going to lead to broader utility of the assay? Or are you going to try to hook up with a drug company as part of a phase three study to make this a companion diagnostic and then hope it gets used, even though I don't think we use that test that Pfizer developed for any of the fusions at Sloan Kettering. We just don't use it. And I'd love to hear, you know, Cecilia comment.
Sure. So I think there's not going to be one solution, first of all. I think there are going to be cases where we're going to partner with a biopharma company, and we're going to develop a diagnostic that we can then take through in a phase three study and get approval. But we had a discussion earlier today, and someone from the FDA was on the panel, where we did talk about basket trials and umbrella trials and how you would get a companion diagnostic approved in that setting. And I think it's going to have to be a dialogue with the FDA. We do have a vision where we can have these universal panels. And it'll be a little different from sequencing, where there is some level of truth in sequencing. You're looking at, is something there or is it not there? In the case of pathway biology, you know, there's some interpretation of the data where now you need to say, is this pathway activated or is it not activated? And in that case, I think it's going to be a discussion with the FDA in order to determine how we can get a universal panel through regulatory approval that can actually look at that pathway biology and where we can actually provide results on what the pathway activation state of these different tumors is. I don't think it's going to be an easy, fast path, but I think it's a path that we have to push on.
So you're really going to try to have assay. I mean, NanoString traditionally has been maybe selling more to the researchers that are mm-hmm. doing retrospective studies. Is the company going to try to really make a major push to be a diagnostics company? Yeah,
absolutely. So we have multiple businesses. We have our research business, it's thriving, and we're excited about that. But we're also excited about moving into diagnostics and into companion diagnostics. And I think that there's you know, the true value to these discoveries that we make in our research is really, you know, translating those discoveries into the clinic, and we want to be a part of that.
So, Cecilia, should we just pretty much start insisting to the FDA that we want to kill companion diagnostics, you know?
Well, I think there's some discussion like that, and that would be very interesting from a clinical practice. So I think there's two ways of looking at it. You have what are the requirements to get regulatory approval, being the FDA, or being in Europe or any other country in the world. So you have to meet those kind of requirements to get approved. Now, having a companion diagnostic does not equal, you know, a clinical adoption and clinical practice, because what's going to be approved with the label not necessarily is going to be adopted in clinical practice. I'm going to go beyond the U.S. and going to, you know, Europe as well. So one of the things that we're doing is, as we get through the regulatory process, is actually understand what are the clinical practices. So to your point, is NanoString going to be available and going to be adopted in every single site? And if that's the case, that's great, you know, but it's not going to be true. And it will change not only from country to country, from region to region, and from clinical practice and cancer type. So it's making available the selection tool that will actually select the best drug for the patient, the best treatment for the patient. Is it going to be a companion? I agree. There's not always going to be a companion diagnostic. It's just not going to happen. Do we need a companion? I think we need the guidelines, and we need to get it through safe drugs to patients. Do we need to be perfect? I'll let Barbara comment on that because we had that discussion at lunch. But I think from a clinician perspective, it's important to understand from Barbara and from Neil, you know, how do they see it, the adoption of a selection tool instead of diagnostic, companion diagnostic in treating patients.
So I don't know if Barbara wants to comment or Neil wants to comment.
Yeah, being involved heavily in development of biomarkers from biomarker du jour to something you can actually use in the clinic, there are a lot of decisions that one wants to make about that. And you know, NanoString's a case in point. NanoString's business is leveraged heavily on government funding. A lot of their business came from starting with the government funding, and that's a good thing. And as far as do we need a companion diagnostic for every drug, I think the answer is you need some way to decide whether that drug is going to benefit that patient. And whether you call it a companion diagnostic or whether you call it a diagnostic, because, you know, you don't need a particular pathologist to tell you you can treat colon cancer with FOLFOX. So when we get to the point where a diagnostic is a diagnostic, I think it really doesn't matter what you call it, but you do have to validate it. You talked apparently a little bit yesterday, I couldn't come yesterday, about the analytical and clinical validation. But ideally, in order to have society or insurance companies pay for something, it has to be useful and you have to get to clinical utility. You cannot get to clinical utility without clinical validation. So you can be analytically validated, but like David said, what are you going to do with these odd mutations that you don't know what they do, and you can prove it maybe because you made it, and you made it in a cell line, and you treated the cell line with something. Is that clinical validation? What do we need? I think as a community, we have to come together about what is clinical validation of these individual variants, and, you know, there's a lot of movement in that direction now, and can you use actual well-curated databases as your backup for your clinical validation?
Clinicians will use this if it works and it's important, and that's also where we'll get it approved. There's lots of stuff to measure in addition to mutations. I would remind you that one of the first targeted therapies were anti-estrogens. Estrogen receptor is not mutated in the enormous majority of the untreated patients. One of the biggest, if not the biggest, triumphs of targeted therapy in the last 2 years have been two non-mutated targets, PI3K delta and BTK. Now, I would guess, totally wildly, that there may be tumors that are PI3K. You know, in other words, can you measure the output of the wild-type PI3K pathway, which is affected by other things? Can you measure output that's epigenetically regulated, which can be much more complex? It's a question of the, to use an old Eastern European proverb, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. That's actually a Southern American proverb. But you get something that works. You get something that works. You get a marker for it. The marker correlates and works for patient correlation. Then you get approval, and then you get insurance companies to pay for it. The other thing, since I probably won't have a chance to talk, I will tell you that precision medicine includes, as David said at the beginning, the drug has to work. And the drug has to work means pharmacodynamics have to be measured. And most companies and academics belong to one religion, the religion of we're never going to measure pharmacodynamics, which costs billions and billions of dollars of wasted money. So an output profile that changes an output profile can be used to measure how well you've inhibited the pathway. I'm not a shy, I get no money, I might have to, no money from NanoString, but it's more easily quantifiable than immunohistochemistry because anything is more easily quantifiable. Nobody does quantitative pharmacodynamics, except for Millennium, Takeda. You know, with proteasome inhibitors, they did it because they had a serum thing to measure. But otherwise, you don't measure it. It's key. It's a big problem in why drugs don't work. So there's lots of markers, and this is obviously not a diagnostic marker. It's a predictive marker in a sense. But there's a lot. I think the problem with markers is when people don't get things to work and they have nothing going on and their drug doesn't work, they say we're going to measure biomarkers. So that's not a reason to develop biomarkers, but there's plenty of good reasons to develop biomarkers that are useful. Yeah, I think I can summarize what both Barbara and I said. If it's useful, and you prove it's useful, people will pay for it, and it will be adapted.
So I guess as the chair, I'm going to use my chair prerogative, I think, to just say what I think should be done, and then the NCI / FDA / other leaders can ultimately agree or not. But to me, DNA sequencing now, I don't think you're going to have to prove that a particular methodology for DNA sequencing was associated with response in a clinical trial. You're simply going to have to be able to prove the surrogate that you're with sufficient sensitivity and specificity accurately detecting specific mutations in DNA. So there is an effort called the Actionable Genome Consortium being coordinated by Illumina to work on standards and bring together a large group of academic institutions that are doing a whole lot of sequencing to simply prove that using Illumina sequencing and maybe other types of DNA sequencing that the results are sufficiently robust that a BRAF mutation is a BRAF mutation is a BRAF mutation, a KRAS mutation is a KRAS mutation, doesn't matter what methodology you used, and thus you won't need companion diagnostics for DNA testing, at least for mutations, and then eventually with fusions. You just need to use a method that has been proven, and you need to do that in a CLIA setting. I think for proteomics and RNA, there really is too much magic in the assay and too much variability to say that. And so I've never seen, I love the idea that you're introducing proteomics, and it gets into what Neil has mentioned in that nobody does good pharmacodynamics. But right now, I do think if you have a gene expression-based profile or you have a proteomic profile, there's enough variability between the methodologies and how they're done that you have to design that into your clinical trial as a companion diagnostic. So that's my personal belief, but I think we could do a great service if we could convince the FDA that for simple gene mutations, it should not matter how you do it. If we can convince payers that they pay a certain amount for KRAS testing for colorectal, that could just then get everybody tested. And those are useful even if you don't have a therapy. They're defining the subgroup of cancer that you have. I actually think we would save a huge amount of money, and I've learned this from the program that we have ongoing. We've done over 3,000 patients in the last 6 months, and I have many of my own patients who I specifically are getting biopsies for genetic testing. And despite the fact that I want nothing but the genetic testing, it seems that our pathology department seems fit to run 86 immunohistochemistry assays on that to prove that they have a cancer that I already know that they have. And so I think that there's a lot of wasted effort that we do. I think we could save a lot of money because I think the genetic testing could actually classify tumors as one group or another. With the next-gen sequencing, we can almost universally say whether a tumor is a new primary or a metastasis from an old cancer, but our lab probably spends $10,000-$12,000 per case in that each of those examples doing different immunohistochemistry stains to try to figure that out. And so I think if we could just agree on the DNA question, maybe we can fix the RNA question later. And I'm just curious, how robust do you think proteomics are now? I still think it's pretty far off in the clinic. I know Neil wants it, but wanting it is not having it. So do you think you have it soon?
Well, we're just launching for life science research now, so I think it'll take some time to translate that into the clinic. But I would agree with you in general. IHC is used in the clinic every day, but it is a sledgehammer of a tool. There have been attempts to take mass spec into the clinic for measuring proteomics, and it's just been a miserable failures there. So I think our work is cut out for us. It's going to be hard, but we're up to the challenge, and something we want to push on. We've pushed RNA measurements into the clinic, and we think we can do the same with protein.
We can do it with RNA. There's a paper that Dr. Solid is a co-author on with me and Christine Pertilis on an RNA profile, 6 genes, that tells you ERK output, it tells you ERK pharmacodynamics. And I think this will be doable for other things as well. I think one has to do this because it's required to make drugs to answer the second part of what you do. It's, you're right. Let's talk about the DNA first because we can do it. But we can't stop the science and both in companies and industry and academics have to keep developing this and have to be doing it.
So I just think to summarize Neil's comment, and then we'll probably take a break for a few minutes before the next panel. To me, the DNA, the technology is there. I don't think we could have said that 3-4 years ago. In 3-4 years ago, we were still doing assays like sequenome. You know, Sanger sequencing was still pretty common in the clinic. The assays we have now are incredibly robust, and I think we just need to convince the regulators that they've achieved that level. I've also been incredibly impressed with circulating free DNA, which I'm not sure has been discussed much at this meeting. One of the problems we have is getting tissue for testing. I've just been shocked how well that works, and I think we're going to see this huge revolution in the next couple of years where we're simply going to be drawing blood from patients, sequencing off circulating free DNA, and at least for all the hotspot mutations and certain fusions, we're going to be able to detect it. I would still say pathway activation and proteomics is aspirational. I have less agreement with Neil that we need to be able to do this to understand why we're seeing variability of response, because it could turn out to be really boring in many patients. This patient responded exceptionally. This patient did not, because this patient has a mutation in their germline that changes metabolism of the drug, and they got more drug to the target and inhibited the target better, and so they responded better. This patient has a mutation that actually causes the drug to be metabolized quickly, not enough drug exposure, you're not hitting the pathway, and the patient does poorly. That could be almost half the variability or more that we see in the clinic. I just don't know how to measure it yet, and I don't think we should hold up the DNA discussion
for that.
We should aspire to develop better assays.
Mind the 60-second anecdote and the 10-second
retort. Of course, we got 60 seconds.
Okay, one is you don't have to, at least at Sloan and at Harvard and probably some other places, you do not have to sequence everybody. It's interesting to me you do in other places, even good places, so that's what the anecdote will be about. But the fact is, precision medicine, and this was my slide, so I'm not going to show them. Precision medicine is let's sequence a lot, and let's do nothing with the fact that we're giving drugs, whether the drugs do, which is ridiculous. The anecdote is this, and it goes back to supporting David. A close friend and colleague of ours, Suraj Chandalapati, is, among other things, a breast cancer doctor at Sloan Kettering. He sequenced a patient who relapsed resistant to tamoxifen. This is, and we see this every day almost now that David is doing all the sequencing. What does the patient have? What's the mutation? Obviously, they have a V600E mutation. Okay?
No, they have an ESR1.
I mean, you find stuff, and you find stuff that's actionable, and you can't not do that. As a former retired physician who is disbarred, I will tell you, you can't not do this. You cannot. I told this to you. When I see a patient 10 years ago with fatal metastatic disease that we could do nothing for, I would say pastoral things on the phone and tell them not to come to Sloan Kettering. Now I say, for the most part, unless they are in a moribund state, I say you need two things. You need to get sequenced, and you need an immunotherapy consult.
So let's just leave it with one more anecdote. Do you want to tell quickly your anecdote of your patient from when you were a fellow at the NCI, your patient from Alabama?
Yes. Who knows Levi Garraway? This is more than 1 minute. I had a patient, and she's not alive, but she was a good friend of mine, became a good friend of mine, a nice African-American woman, very old, my age now, in her mid-60s, at the NCI in Building 10 on the 12th floor, who had horribly metastatic breast cancer. Filled the marrow and lymphangitic spread everywhere and in the ICU. And we had a protocol at that time for targeted therapy. High dose methotrexate and 5-FU. In retrospect, I have no idea how I gave this unbelievably sick patient those two drugs, but I did. I was a kamikaze from a city hospital. And as usual, the tumor went away completely, okay, CR, all right, and no idea why, obviously, this is 1983 or 4, went away completely, 36 patients on the trial, it's the same as David's bladder trial, 35 progressed right through this. This was the one patient. So this is how I diagnosed cognitive dissonance. I had to go through life saying this is an ineffective therapy when I performed a miracle with this therapy.
Yes.
Now, this woman lived for 7 more years. I know because every Christmas she sent me pecans from her the tree in her house in Birmingham. And the Levi part of this story is, well, I did a stupid New York thing. We never knew. Now we would sequence, and maybe we'd do some biochemistry.
I was
going
to, at the end, say, why didn't you submit her case to the NCI Extraordinary Responder Initiative?
Okay. It's at the time we were looking for T-cell viruses. So just for those of you who know Levi, Levi was going down to Birmingham for the 100th or 95th anniversary, birthday of his grandmother. And I did a stupid thing, like you see a Chinese guy who's from Beijing, and you say, I know somebody from Beijing, maybe you know them. I said, Levi, I knew one person from Birmingham, Alabama, Olean Underwood. And Levi comes back very excited and says, she was best friends with my grandmother. And they sent her really sick to the NCI in the early 80s, and it was a miracle. She came back, and it was a miracle. Now, for those of you who don't like low-frequency tumors and it's too small a market, for me, the smallest market that I will aim at is one patient. I know that's a smarmy-type thing to say, but let me tell you, it's an exhilarating thing to see one of these. With Barbara and David and everybody else doing this, you will be able to sum the mutations, figure out the complexity. If you don't start now, you'll never happen.
So that one patient was a missed opportunity because Neil was not smart enough to collect the tumor and save it 30 years till now. But I think that the key is going forward. My hope is that none of these opportunities are missed. They could tell us interesting biology about other patients, maybe identify new drug targets or co-mutations. And just as the last selling point, to do this, though, you have to remember to collect the tissue. You have to consent these patients. If that doesn't happen, you miss that opportunity. I'm just going to – one more anecdote, and we'll end the session. As we were doing the Extraordinary Responder Initiative, one of our breast doctors came up to us, you know, and told us about a patient who was on an HSP90 trial who had had a dramatic response for over a year. Then the patient went on and died. And this was – at this time, that doctor never thought to mention either to me or Neil – that this had happened, maybe we would have said, give us the tumor, we will analyze it. And that was a missed opportunity. We didn't find out why that patient had responded. And we had worked on HSP90 inhibitors for years. We really could have used that tumor. And so these are anecdotes, but I think that they can make an impact more broadly. And thanks for coming to the session. So thanks.
So, David, just one second. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah.